short of it, I don't want to say attacked, but it kind of was.
Oh shit.
Yeah, basically, from where was I? I was in this place called Andover, and I've had a lot of people message me going, oh, Andover's not that much of a shithole, all this kind of thing. And I was just like,
Okay.
I'm not too sure about that, but basically, long and short of it, I was, it was probably about 10, half 10 at night, and I was riding from, through Andover, and I cut into a park to have a piss, as you would, pretty standard. And I had a bunch of guys come up to me and sort of try and push me off the bike and take the bike.
Cool.
Yeah, really nice.
You're okay though.
Yeah, I'm all right. I was a bit rattled up by it.
And you were alone.
I was on my own. Yeah, didn't get pushed off the bike, so managed to not have the bike stolen. And then we were filming it. The whole thing was being filmed.
But
that didn't get filmed. The guys that were filming were like half an hour up the road. But basically, it was all being filmed for Shimano, and I saw the guys like half an hour afterwards, and they were like, "Are you all right?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not all right." And they were like, "What's happened?" They explained the situation to them, and they were like, "Okay, let's just stop for the evening and
get
a camper van. Let's stop for the evening and see how you feel in the morning, and we can then redecide whether you want to carry on or that sort of thing." And we took parked up the camper van, slept for the night, and I was just like, "Don't want to ride my bike." I literally don't want to ride my bike. I've very rarely have ever been like, "I don't want to go for a cycle." And literally, just no motivation to cycle or anything. I was just like, "Nah, done." So we stopped, pulled the pin on it. Yeah, it's frustrating because I was doing it to raise money for charity as well. Like, and doing it for basically to raise awareness for testicular cancer.
I was going to say it would be really ironic if it was like an anti-bullying charity or something, but like
the irony of it being testicular cancer and a bunch of guys. And I think the statistics are, it's like, I think it was five blokes.
Oh, and one of them will probably get it.
At least one of those five will have to have tests to see if, you know, at least one of them is going to have an abnormal lump at some point in their life, but probably more than one. And it is very frustrating in a situation where, you know, you're trying to do something for a good cause and you just get a big old, literally a slap in the face. And so, yeah, the last week has been basically me dealing with the police trying to work out what we could do.
I'm guessing not much, huh?
Nothing. Because it happened in a park, there's no CCTV.
Right.
I didn't have a camera on me or anything.
They didn't actually get anything. They just, so it's not like you can track where it's being resold because they didn't steal your bike. So
yeah, the bike.
Maybe it helps. Sorry. Maybe in a week you'll be able to take whatever footage you have and then it stops suddenly.
Yeah.
And then you can talk about what happened and then actually say statistically one in five of those guys, and then you can cut it there.
Yeah. So we had
more of an impact and raise more awareness than, you know.
So we had a big chat about this. I've started recording because I thought, bugger it, I'm going to start recording. Say no.
Okay.
Purely because I was like, fuck it, I'm going to start recording. I just was in that mindset. I knew I would probably forget.
Okay.
I've done that before where I forgot to record and then realized an hour has gone past, which is never good. So anyway, we had a big chat with Shimano about it. And they were like, they very honestly were like, what's your stance on it, Chris? And I was like, well, it was shit. I would like to do it again, but I'm not certain when I would like to have another go. And then we kept talking about it quite a bit. And we were talking like what we could do with what we've already got. Like I got over halfway. I was 400 kilometers into it. It was 600 and 90 kilometers in total. I got 400k done in like 15 hours. So it's pretty damn good. I was pretty chuffed with that. And anyway, we were like, what do you want to do? Like, do you want to, they were like, do you want to go to the point where you, the incident happens and then carry on riding the remaining 290k? Or do you want to start from scratch? Do you want to, what would you like to do? And I sat there and I thought about it for a while and I was like, do you know what? I'd like to do it again from the start and do it properly. And they were like, right, when are you thinking about doing it? And I was like, I don't know, maybe the end of May. And they were literally like, what, seriously? And I was like, yeah, well, I'd rather get it done and not have to, this kind of done then, like it will eat away at me if I keep waiting.
I reckon you should do a call out. You should talk about it publicly and then do a call out to get as many cyclists as you can to join you for that part.
Yeah.
And go through that park with like a crazy amount of cyclists for like safety, and that will raise more awareness than anything.
It'd be quite funny. Like I didn't, so when I did the first one, I very intentionally didn't talk about it because just I think until the day before, purely because of the COVID restrictions in the UK at the moment. And because I knew that if I talked about it, people would like make arrangements to like come out and ride with it, which is fine, but I felt like I was maybe pushing the limits and the regulations out there anyway, as it was, by cycling across the country. But in the UK anyway, the restrictions are lifting day by day, really.
Every week it's a new,
But they're looking here, the plan is to be locked down, completely lifted by the 21st of June, which is crazy. Anyway,
everybody can go back to their Wetherspoons for a Taco Tuesday or whatever it is.
Oh my God, Wetherspoons. Yeah, there's one of them where I now live and it's the busiest place still in London.
Was it a theater or a bank before it was a Wetherspoons?
Actually, do you know what? I think it was just a pub before.
Okay. But
there is definitely a standard that they're old cinemas or banks or something, isn't it?
Sometimes bingo halls.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, how are you?
All right.
Yeah.
Where is the sun in Girona?
I was going to say, are you in Girona right now?
Mm-hmm.
Is it sunny?
Mm-hmm. It's 24 degrees today. Going to the beach later. So,
you know what we've had in the UK this morning and yesterday? We had snow.
Yeah. And isn't it election day today?
It is like local council election day, so your local your local politician in the area you live in, which is quite ironic for me because I only moved here 2 months ago, so I don't even know who they are. But
so where are you?
I am in the border of the Peak District now.
Oh, you're up north.
Yeah, moved out of London two and a half months ago. And there was definitely this.
A lot of people have in the last year left London. So.
Yeah, massively so. There's been this trend. All of my mates have left. They've literally gone from being in, central London to, I think the furthest north is like Durham, Newcastle way.
Wow, okay.
And they've all gone, but the majority have gone north because it's so much cheaper. Like the amount you can get for your money is crazy. Yeah. Yeah, so there's, I think, Newcastle, Durham, Peak District, and York. That's where everyone's gone, of my like close open mates. But there's definitely been, I think, lockdown in the UK anyway, made a lot of people in cities realise you don't need to be there. Mm. Like working from home, working remotely, it kind of opened up that option. And I think I heard something in the news today that was saying that the top 50 company, the top, I don't know what top 50 they are, but the top 50 companies in the UK, top 50 what? Like top 50 Haribo sweet eating companies? I don't know. Could be anything. But the top 50 companies have said they're not going to enforce returning back to offices, which is pretty nuts. And I think the stance on it has definitely meant that there's a more of an acceptance of home working. And you know, we've kind of technically in the UK, we've been in the current lockdown since November, really.
I know.
And then before that, it was, you know,
on. No, because I was there in December, like right when there was like a little break. Like I came right when the, and it was. But I mean, honestly, I was so confused. I got there and was like, well, the pubs are open and the government says it's okay. So we're all going to the pubs. And I'm like, pubs are not ventilated, people. Like, what is this? Like, just because the government said you can open pubs, like, whose brain's still. And then unsurprisingly, like 2 weeks later, it was like, eh, we're going back into lockdown.
Was that at the start of December then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was like regional lockdowns before then. Yeah. And then there was this like promise that, oh, you'd be able to go and see your families and stuff for Christmas. And then it was like, pow. No.
And then, yeah, I know. And it's crazy because I think we've been really lucky in Spain and Andorra for just being in small towns.
Yeah.
Like we don't realize how easy it is kind of, because even though Girona feels like a city to us because it's quite compact, it's like 90,000 people here. So it just doesn't have that same, like, I didn't feel safe in London. I was like, ah, there's so many people. Nobody's wearing masks. I don't know who these people are, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody's quite like compliant and chill and everything's outside because it's Spain. So like all the restaurants are open, but they're all, you just sit outside. So.
Yeah, it's definitely you're lucky you have the conditions to be able to do that. Like loads of restaurants and stuff have reopened, and but you have to eat outside. So you're going to them with as many layers as you can. And you turn up in the massive puffer jackets. And we've done that a couple of times recently. And I've just been like, this is not enjoyable. I'd rather just stay at home and eat, like, cook
a takeaway.
Why not? But it's been such an interesting like thing. I mean, it's incredibly sad how many people have passed away, obviously, and how many people it's affected in their lives when you talk about work, mental health, all that kind of side of it. But it's also incredibly interesting to see how different countries have coped and have been affected by it. How, you know, we've never seen anything like this in our lifetime. You know, I think just from like my perspective, I got made redundant and I was just like, fuck it, I'm going to try and make it work, do what I can on my own, see if I can make it work, and see if I can make a job by doing, I don't really know what I'm doing half the time, but see if I can make it work as a job and a career. And then also choosing to move out of London, which was, as I say, quite a big decision, but I ultimately feel like for my own and my partner's own like mental health, the right decision. You know, we now have a national park on our doorstep, we have three floors of a house as opposed to a little flat, you know.
Yeah, you just have, now you only have 2 days of summer compared to 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think we've had them as well. I think we've had those 2 days as it is. But yeah, it's been fascinating to see how the world's kind of cope with it. And obviously the situation in like India, Brazil, etc. That's really horrible.
And like, I have to tell you that sometimes like when I've been traveling to bike races this year, there is this feeling of like, why is this happening? Like there is a real feeling of like,
really?
Yeah, like, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I'm like, this doesn't seem like it's a necessity, but yeah.
Yeah, so it's been fascinating to see that so many races have gone ahead. There's so few who have actually been cancelled. I can probably count it on my hands how many the more well-known ones anyway. There's obviously loads of smaller races have been cancelled, but a lot of them more compared to last year when it was like, oh, there's another one cancelled or rescheduled. This year, it feels like there's been
there's been enough to keep it going.
Yeah, definitely. There's been enough.
Apparently, the Belgian government was like, we're having this because people were getting so depressed in Belgium about not having bike racing that they were like, we've got to do it and put it on TV for our population. So
it's a national sport in Belgium, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So they really like, it was really this huge thing from the Belgian government to be like, we're doing it. So, which is kind of cute, actually.
I think what's like, for me, what fascinates me about you is you literally get to see so many races firsthand, document it, kind of just talk about it and really live and breathe the life of what is actually going on.
Like, yeah, yes.
And I can,
like, do I?
Yeah, much more so than the majority of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also being Girona based, you're, I mean, there's so many of like the Spanish races out there, which are in pretty close proximity to you, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been really fascinating, kind of like the photography stuff as well. Some of the photos are beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
I think one I saw recently, it was some time trial ones.
Who knows? Probably.
And, yeah, it's just like, it's been really nice to follow what you're doing over, I don't even know how many years it's probably been now.
I don't know. I've lost track. It's just the endless circus, isn't it? Were the time trial photos of Alex? They very well could have been.
Probably. That, and he's off to the Giro again.
He is at the Giro, I know. So.
But I have not properly spoken to that silly sausage for quite a while, actually. I saw that. I should call him just out of the blue and call him.
Just video call him in now. He'd be like, "What do you guys want?"
Well, you know what you'd get? You'd get the grumpy face.
Yeah.
Which his daughter has the same face.
Yeah.
She really does, doesn't she? It's very sweet.
Very sweet.
I
don't know what my time trial photos were. I'll have to look through that and work it out. But yeah, no, I do go to a lot of races, and I don't know, maybe it's a different perspective. I don't know. You know, I live in Girona, so I live in it. They're not like, it's kind of a little bit of everything, having like the background in journalism and starting through journalism and then clearly being married to a professional cyclist has like shifted that into more of a content creator, because you can't be a straight journalist when you're, you know, and do like hardcore reporting when you have coffee and dinner with the people, because there's no way to not have the bias. Yeah. So maybe just made my own niche out of it, because out of necessity. It's fun. It's, you know, it's crazy. I'm off to Basque country in a few days. It's really nice to go to the races, like especially some of the women's races that don't get a lot of coverage, because you actually get to show that story a bit more.
It does feel like, there's a few things you've mentioned there, which I'm going to go to quickly. Your partner, name your partner.
Nathan Haas.
What's his next race?
He's actually going to Mallorca next week for the 4 days of Mallorca Challenge. It's been a bit, he got really sick. So I don't know if people saw he had COVID at some point. We don't really know when, because he was getting tested like 3 times a week. He never had a positive test for it, which is like, I swear, never returned a positive test. It has a whole new meaning in 2021. I think Alex actually said that last year as well. But then he has the antibodies and he was really sick. So we don't know when that happened. So they're just starting him again with Mallorca after a really big break from a variety of stuff that happens. It's not fun. But he's excited to get back to racing. He's in Andorra this week, actually, training. So.
Yeah, I've seen he's been out there in Andorra riding around, lucky sod.
Except it's cold.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but it's still pretty.
Yeah, it is.
Still really pretty. So, and like, if anyone doesn't know Nathan's raced, previously he was at Dimension Data for a long time, wasn't he?
Just 2 years. It was only 2 years. He was at Garmin, Dimension Data, Katusha, and now he's with Cofidis, so.
Yeah, it was Katusha as well, wasn't it? I forgot about that one. And Cofidis now. And kind of, I mean, you know, pretty, it feels like he's kind of that team feels like it's actually improved a lot recently with the kind of riders they've signed.
Yeah.
You know, there's some, getting Elia Viviani as well. That's pretty damn cool. Who everyone says is one of the nicest men in the world. And
this is Guillaume Martin, is just like, I just really love Guillaume Martin's whole vibe. Like, I mean, the dude's written a book about philosophy in cycling. Like, I don't know. I feel like somehow, you know, so like the French cycling thing has been so just like myopically focused on Pinot and Bardet for so long. I think it's now the time to talk about Guillaume Martin.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Yes, it's tricky. I mean, Pinot, I really like him. And I think the reason why I really like him is his goats.
Yeah.
That for me, I think is so adorable and makes him really like human as well. And was it the year before when he had to stop in the Tour de France because of his back or something?
Both? I think it was last year.
It was a time, I think it was, the one that I'm thinking of, I think is 2019, when he lost
a bunch of time on a stage in crosswinds. I actually have a photo of it. It's like, I'm going to find the photo of this. It was a great photo. So it started, it was like in the middle of the race and he lost a bunch of time in a crosswind stage.
Yeah.
And that was like the start of the end of that tour. I don't know what it's, I think it must be really hard if you have so much pressure on you as a GC rider and
being French as well.
It can just disappear so quickly. One bad day and you just can't get it back. You know, it must be horrible.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine the pressure of it. I mean, you look at what's been on the men's side of the sport, what's been so fascinating is how, he does not look happy.
So everybody was interviewing him and I didn't care to interview him. So I was just standing behind him and got the photo as he turned away from the, reporters.
Yeah.
It's
such a, like, I found with Pino, like I've grown to like him more.
Yeah.
As he's got older. And I think that is because he comes across that he comes across as quite an emotional man. And it's actually really quite refreshing to see. Bardet just is classy.
He's so sweet. He's such a sweet guy and he's so classy. I know. It's like, yeah.
I remember he turned up to one of the Red Hook crits.
Oh my God. No way.
Yeah, he turned up to Red Hook Crit.
Roman Bardet.
Yeah, just to watch. Literally just to watch it. And
okay, at least he wasn't racing it, to be fair.
No, he wasn't racing. He turned up to watch it. I think it was, my mate Owen told me about it. I think it was New York, I want to say. And Owen's like a massive cycling fan. Like, he's a huge lover of the sport. He is now the chef for EF as well, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
Or one of the chefs for EF. He's out at the Giro with them effectively. He was like, yeah, I bumped into Roman Bardet at Red Hook. And I was like, are you serious? He's like, yeah, he was just coming and watching. He was just like, such a classy man and so polite. Just so well-dressed.
Yeah, I mean, super well-dressed.
So. Yeah. And I mean, as you say, Pino and Bardet, the pressure they've had from the French media,
I don't know.
I think it's probably meant they have probably not achieved. I think the additional pressure that has been put on them is probably what stopped them achieving as well as they probably could have, if I'm honest with you. And they are, you know, I really would like one of them to do something. Really, I would love one of them to do something and just catch everyone off guard. And I think Bardet moving to DSM is probably a really good move because it's just a bit of a fresh start for him.
And that team is always so good in Grand Tours too. So let's see. I mean, they've got him and Jai together at the Giro this year. So, which That's is also good. Nice to have two people that the pressure is not just on one. So,
and has Bardet ever done the Giro before? I don't think he has.
I don't know. Probably not.
I'm pretty sure he's only always done the Tour de France and not focused on the Giro or the Vuelta. So that's, you know, it could be could be a big weight off his shoulders, actually. Maybe he's not even going to go to the Tour. Who knows?
Maybe he's focused on the Olympics.
Good point. Mm-hmm. If it happens.
Yeah. They're vaccinating people for it.
I mean, we could have a
Zwift Olympics now.
Zwift Olympics. Well, I was just trying to think, like, who the current Olympic champions are. Are they going to be
going? If we have another 4 years with Greg Van Avermaet in a fucking gold helmet, I'm done. Like, seriously. At least Anna van der Breggen has not been, like, milking that for 5 years.
The difference is she doesn't need to milk it.
Okay, fair point.
He does need to milk it.
Like, dude, let it go. Maybe for like a year after it was okay, but come on, man. Like, I'm gonna get in trouble. He's gonna listen to this. He's gonna be like, who is that bitch? No, come on. Everybody thinks it. Let's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the Rio Olympics, that was pretty insane, that road race. And I don't think anyone expected either of them to win the men's or the women's race. They weren't the favourites, by a long shot. So I kind of get why he's milked it a bit, but I do think he has maybe gone a little bit too much of it. I mean, when he was at CCC and he had a gold giant, that was probably the bit, well, that's where I was like, it just looks a bit...
He's still going. Like...
Yeah. At least the BMC now looks quite classy because it's white with a bit of gold on it. When it was CCC and it was a proper gold giant, whatever.
And the gold helmet and the gold glasses and the gold shoes. It's just like, I don't know. It's
Yeah, it was a bit much, wasn't it? But Van der Breggen just like, I don't know, she just seems like the classiest.
Well, she's got world championship stripes now. They kind of trump Olympic colors, don't they?
Why has she not got stripes for? European, worlds, national, I think.
Sure, at some point.
Probably got national at some point. But to be fair, to be national champion, to be a national champion of the Netherlands, it's pretty much like being a world champion anyway, isn't it? World
champion, yeah. It might be harder because you're actually racing against all those other people that are on your team for worlds. So,
yeah.
I'm curious to know if the Dutch girls think that nationals are harder than worlds.
It's got to be, hasn't it? It's got to be. It's crazy how strong the Dutch... the Dutch teams are, full stop. I mean, men's and women's fields, definitely. But the women's Dutch riders is insane. Like,
insane, isn't it?
Yeah. And anyway, going back to the other thing that you mentioned there briefly, was talking about women's races. And that's something I was really keen to talk about with you anyway. And for your reference, and pretty much anyone who ever listens to these podcasts, no, I don't script anything. I just freestyle it and let the conversation go, because I think it's much nicer. And that's always been my stance, because there is much of a thing for me to have a conversation with someone is really nice. And then I always wanted to do it so that it was like people just listening into conversations. And people seem to like it. There's, postman. There's like 40 something episodes now. So it seems to be going all right.
People are listening. Sorry to anybody that we're horribly boring if we're you right now.
And they can turn off.
Yeah.
women's racing. I hands down think that women's bike racing is better to watch than men's.
Yeah.
I do not care what people say on that. It's way more unpredictable. Yeah. I mean, I'm gonna put a little asterisk to this. I think both men's and women's racing over the last year or COVID period has been so much more unpredictable, because it feels like every single race, everyone's going there and going, I don't know when I'm going to race next, so I'm going to go for it.
Which is also a little bit insane though. So I think, women's racing has been, so the races tend to be shorter. They're a bit more dynamic, I think, recently. I think one of the things that's happened with men's racing as well is that you have, where it's like the generation of super freaks. Like, I don't know who these guys are. Mm. Like, but they're winning everything. Yeah. And then as well, because so many of the men's races, of the smaller races, are getting canceled, you're not getting, these guys are entering everything. So like, what is Wout van Aert doing at Trano trying to like do a good GC? It's because they don't have like the other prep races that they might have for something else, because all of those have been canceled. So you're getting these Tour de France star lists. Like, what was it? Like a 12 Assange? Like, what the fuck was
that? Yeah, that was weird, wasn't it?
So then the only downside of that for the men is that I actually think some of the smaller riders aren't getting the same opportunities. Like, you have teams like EF that are actually only doing a World Tour program this year. And so some of the smaller riders don't get the same opportunities that they would, and you have all these really strong guys showing up. So it does feel a bit scripted when you have these big teams and these big players that are targeting absolutely everything. Even with things like without having like the Tour Down Under this year, where you always get like some crazy, you know, Richie always wins on Wollongong, but like the stages can be kind of.
Didn't win the last one though, did he?
I know, but well, I'm not sure that counted, but like, you know what I mean? It's really unpredictable. It's really different. It's people are, you know, a lot of European guys are not targeting Tour Down Under. So there's a bunch of opportunities there. That stuff hasn't happened this year. The women's races, definitely. I mean, your top five, the top five, even maybe up to top 10, they tend to be sort of, it's very clear who those girls are, but the racing and the dynamic of it is so much more interesting, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Like, what I've always thought with the women's racing, in especially ones I've watched recently, like you can't, there's a certain few riders you can't look past. Like we all know that. The majority of those few riders are Dutch as well, ironically. There obviously are a few exceptions to that. And I think you can look at, say, for example, SD Works as a team and go, that team is insane. Everything about that team on paper is ridiculous. And it was, in its previous iteration, it was pretty similar, to be fair. They were just a super, super strong team. But you look across all of the women's teams, and especially like when we look at Van Vleuten going to Movistar, that's really up that team. And I can't think of the
woman. And Emma team. There as well. With
her. That's it.
She's
just come kind of, everyone's kind of known about her, but she's proper come like stepped up the mark this year.
I had coffee with her yesterday morning, actually. I was like, finally, because, oh man, like, and the thing about Emma, I have to say, and everybody should be a fan of Emma, like she's 22 years old, right? Yeah. So many riders, if they had that spring, they would be so frustrated. Like she won every bunch sprint when somebody was solo ahead of her. And then every finish, it was like a bunch sprint, she was second.
Yeah.
Like, but she was not stressed. She was just like laughing about it. She was more determined. And if you look at that first sprint stage in Elsie, I was like, Emma, I'm not even sure that was a sprint. That may have been a solo attack because you won by like a kilometer. And she has, you know, she's got a super healthy attitude. She's just strong. She's happy. She's well supported. And it's a great example. She's going to be one to watch for like the next 10 years for sure. Like she's 22.
I doing at 22?
I was at the pub. I was probably hanging out with bike messengers or something. Who knows? Riding my fixed gear around town thinking I was cool.
I would have been working in architecture, sitting at a desk probably for 20 hours a day. So
you're making money.
You say that compared to the hours that you work, not making money.
Yeah.
But yeah, like and Movistar seem to have like their women's team is really strong. And then we've had like, obviously you can't really look past Trek Segafredo, also a super, super strong team. Yeah. And I mean, all of the Trek Segafredo kit and the national champs jerseys just look so
good. It's so funny because you can't, you're like, where's Trek? Because they're all in different jerseys, like every race. It's so funny. It's like,
And then we've already sort of said about SD Works, their just lineup is insane. And then like when Ashley Moore and Passio went there as well, I was just like,
I know.
Why are they making this team any stronger?
Yeah, and, I know.
But then there's always the odd outsiders. Like, I mean, Marianne Vos and the Jumbo Visma team. Marianne Vos is like one of my favorite cyclists of all time. For many people, to be perfectly honest. And I say that because of, you look at how she has won almost everything in some way, shape or form from every single type of discipline of bike riding, and there's no one, men's or women's peloton currently, and probably for quite a long time, who's done that.
Yeah. I'm sure you saw, but did you see, I don't know who it was, somebody sent out a tweet that was like, has anybody ever done everything that Wout Van Aert has done? Like, name one cyclist that's ever been able to time trial and climb and sprint. And that person just got slammed. Like, there was hundreds of responses that just said Mariana.
Yeah.
And it was so funny, I'll be honest. It was like, yeah.
She's still got I think she's still got a good few years left in her as well. Like,
yeah, for sure. She's incredible. I mean, then of course there was also the example of somebody around Flesh that tried to say that like Valverde held the record of wins and also just got slammed.
Yeah.
But it is funny to see. But it's actually really nice to see, because I think more and more people, it's not just like the three or four of us that are like, hey, don't forget it. It's more and more people that are actually going, oh, actually, you know, Anna van der Breggen is the record holder for most wins of Flesch. Like, stop dismissing that. And it's becoming more and more of a group of people that are saying, not just a few of us. Like,
yeah,
it's nice to see. The popularity is definitely growing. It's all, yeah, and like you said, back to the first part, it's because the racing, yeah, it is really exciting. Like, I watched women's Amstel, I didn't watch men's Amstel, I'll be honest. Yeah. Like, you know.
It just, there's definitely, you can't predict who's going to win it. No. That's like, that, I mean, you could maybe predict it into, I don't know, a group of potentially 10 or 15, but... Yeah. Like, in comparison to some of the like men's races where you can go, ah, it's going to be one of these three. Like, and still you can't, I just think like there seems to be a lot more, almost, as you said, the women's races are shorter, but I think that makes it better quite a lot of the time.
I think there's also something where they're racing, I don't want to say that it's raw talent, but like in a little way, you could say that it is. Like, clearly the difference in budget between SD Works and like a smaller women's team is significant.
Yeah.
But when you look at the men's racing, you tend to have the guys from the super teams that are always on the podium, and it's the money and everything that goes into it. And the difference between the budget of Ineos and the budget of Quebeca Assos.
Oh yeah.
Is bigger, right? And that's why everybody at Strada is like so stoked that Michael Gogol's in there, right? And they're just like, this is awesome to see. But I think the women's racing, there's less differentiation. Like, you really see the talent, and it's just raw instinct. And that's one of the reasons that it's so exciting. It's not just these big machines of these teams that have been racing and riding the front and launching the guys off. It's, they're racing, they race so hard.
Yeah.
And of course, having a strong team always helps, because one of the things you see with women's races is so many attacks will go and then one will stick and you never know which one it is. And you need to be represented in most of them to have success like SD Works has, where SD Works goes into any race and goes, right, any four of you could win today. But it's just so much more dynamic to watch. That's,
yeah, completely. I mean, I saw something a while ago. I wonder if I can find it quickly. That was talking about, men's world tour team budgets, and it was actually a thing that I did for an old client, and it was breaking down the budgets, I think from 2018 or something, and purely because there hasn't been a lot of information like put out there for much more recently, and of course going much more recently, those budgets are going to be tenfold again, and the gap between Ineos to, as you say, Quebeca Assos, or I think it was actually Movistar's budget isn't as big as a lot of people think it is.
People think now.
You know, when you start to see that kind of thing, it's kind of like, oh shit, okay, here we go. So this is 2019 team budgets, and it's only highlighting the men's teams.
Yeah, tell me the top and the bottom.
So top is Ineos, $25 million. I'll do the top three and the bottom three. Yeah. Second is Astana with 14. And yeah, third was CCC.
Okay.
With 12.5. Well, joint third was CCC and Quickstep, 12.5 million.
Right.
And then in contrast, you go to the bottom end of it, Arkea Samsic, 2.5 million. Total Direct Energy, 4.25. And then Bahrain Merida, 5 million. And, you know, looking sort of middle park, Sunweb's on 9, Azure 2's on 8.5, EF's 8.5, Trek's 8.5. But that the big headline thing is Ineos being first on 25 million in 2019. Second place.
I think it might even be more than that, to be honest.
It'll be more than that now, 100%.
I think those numbers might all be actually even at the bottom. But like, I think, but it's, yeah, it's crazy. That's such a difference, right? The thing that people don't think about as well is that once a team is, so like you use Movistar as an example, and I think it's a really interesting example. You said actually Movistar's on a lot less. This is actually one of the things that happened at Katusha. So, you know, I worked with them for a few years, is that everybody assumed that Katusha was this massively budgeted team, but it was, and then it kept getting cut and cut and cut and cut and cut over the years. And then they were one of the smallest budget teams, but nobody knew that. Everybody just assumed that it was like this massive budget team.
Yeah, but it's because it's been going for
so long. And the same thing will have been the case with Movistar, is at one point they will have been huge budget, and then it's just sort of like takes a little bit out every year. And you don't always get, especially when you have a sort of solo sponsored teams, you don't really know. Like, you know, Cofidis goes, oh, we'll up our budget by a million next year. And you're like, cool, you know. But it changes so much, and it changes based on the sponsor, and yeah.
What do you think is the solution to that, though? Because we keep seeing teams fall.
I have like a radically left solution, which Nathan was like, lovely idea, Laura, would never work. Is I think every team should submit 20% of their budget into a pool. Yeah. And then it all gets divided evenly, like a nice bit of socialism. So, you know, I'm sure I'm going to lose a few followers off that.
But I mean, the thing is that if you think of it like very logically, it makes a lot of sense, because the problem we're having, and we have it every single year, and I think it was in fact accelerated massively last year, was the situation with teams folding. Katusha folded, what was that, a couple of years ago now? And Katusha had been going for a long time. Like, that was a very recognizable, the kit was so recognizable, massive K on the back of the jersey, and it always was that. And, you know, I mean, I can't even think how long Katusha was going, but you think that team must have been 10 years at least.
But it was, to be honest, it was going longer, like the structure around it was going for longer than that. And it's these weird things that, I mean, a lot of the structure of Katusha was born out of U.S. Postal, which just sounds bad, but he never dies. It just, you know.
Rebranded.
I mean, the thing is, you say U.S. Postal, well, guess what? Garmin had the U.S. Postal bus until like 3 years ago. The service course in Girona is the old U.S. Postal service course. So I know it sounds bad, right? But I don't mean for it to sound bad like that, but like the staff, you're mainly talking about when a team folds, what happens to the staff and where that goes, and who's, and so the structure around, and not just the staff at races, but the staff and the 30 people that work for a team that nobody ever sees or knows about, that are working in the offices and running sponsorship and logistics and all this stuff, those structures tend to carry on through years until a team really folds, like Katusha did. And they were all put out of work, basically, which was a shame. So, yeah.
I mean, the big one that was a stress to follow was Quebec or Assos.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Doug Ryder has done from an external perspective, I don't personally know Doug, and I don't really know many people at the team. Seeing what he'd done with that team from MTN Quebec days to then, as we go, ended up merging into Dimension Data and then NTT and now Quebec Assos, it felt like the Dimension Data days were like, it felt like that was kind of like the peak days of it.
Of like results, Cav and Eddie and Steve Cummings, and they were so cool. And they had Scott doing their photos, and
that's when it felt like it was kind of at its peak. You know, as you say, Cav was winning stages. You had Boston Hagen there. You had Bernie Eisel there. Mark Renshaw. Like, it felt like a real proper, really cool. Like, it was my favorite team back then, hands down.
Everybody loved them. They were the underdogs.
Steve Cummings winning on Mandela Day, like that was incredible. And then it felt like things kind of tailed off a bit, unfortunately. But the fact that, and then it was that point, wasn't it? Like last year, when the riders didn't know they were going to have a contract, and we saw, you know, some of the bigger riders in the team, Ben O'Connor, for example, shifting over. Like, and there was definitely, I think it felt like there was a genuine concern that team was going to fold.
I honestly work with Doug really close. I have for years. We run the, until COVID killed it, but we were running the Girona Gala for Quebeca long after Nathan wasn't on the team anymore even.
Yeah.
And like we're, you know, both Nathan and I are really committed to supporting Quebeca and support. I do all their headshots for them every year and stuff. You know, that team has always been family to me and they always will be. I think there was actually genuine concern. I don't think it was riders jumping ship to some degree as well. I think everybody does take an opportunity. Ben had been there since he was in NeoPro, and I think it's really important for riders to step away sometimes to try to move on. You do have some riders like Alex Howes, will his entire career will have been at one team, been a Garmin from when it was like a development team basically.
Yeah.
Until, and that is, I mean, there's a few riders that have that, but I think a lot of riders, they do need to step away to progress and sort of, you know, when you come in and you're a baby, it's hard to not always be the baby.
Yes, you know, exactly. Here.
So I think for a lot of them, it was quite hard. Like I know Ben King, I think was really upset to leave, but they, you know, what do you want me to say? If Nathan was in that position, I would have told him to leave if somebody else was offering him a job. Cause it's like, you know, if it folds in January and December and you don't have another offer, you're not getting one. Like it's horribly cutthroat, but I think they'll come back together. I think it was really tough for them because they also lost a lot of in for that team in the few years, they lost a lot of those personalities. And it's sort of funny because we go back and say, oh, like, this is why we love Bardet and Pino. And that's what also we loved about that team. Like you want to talk about classy guys. Cav is one of the classiest bike riders we will ever have, you know, and anybody that wants to call him an asshole, like get through me first, you know, like, and they lost a lot of those riders because of the changes in sponsorship, because of the changes in direction, because sponsors sometimes dictate what they want to see with the team. I think it's great to see where they are now, because I think that Doug has kind of refocused it. And now he gets to sort of direct it again. Then they've gone back to being these underdogs. And they're smashing it. You know, they're getting good results for where they are and in the budget. And
it's so much nicer to see. It feels like there's been a real breath of fresh air there. And, you know, when it was Dimension Data, that felt like it was a really good time. And then the NTT thing all felt a bit weird. And I know that all came around because NTT bought Dimension Data, basically. But it all felt very weird and a bit segregated and a bit separate. And I just didn't like the kit. I'll be blunt.
It's all about the kid, isn't it?
I'm glad it was boring. And then, you know, seeing, like, I'm good friends with the guys from Aero Coach, and I know the guys at Hunt Wheels really well as well. And I, you know, they sort of saw that it was an opportunity to help out in a way that would be good for everyone involved. Like for Aero Coach, it's, you know, it's about having the riders using their extensions and stuff on the TT bikes, which is really a great exposure for a tiny company. And similarly for Hunt, you know, people have a perception that Hunt is a massive brand and really, really not a huge brand. I mean,
they're like three kids from Yorkshire. I swear they're all 12. I'm sorry. Sorry, Ollie.
I remember when they started, like I used to ride with, there's three brothers and a dad. And I used to ride with one of the brothers quite a lot, whose nickname is Shouty because he's very loud. And basically it's, you know, it's a small family run business and it's slowly grown and grown and grown. And admittedly, yes, they are a lot bigger than they were like 5-10 years ago, but they're still a small company. Like both Aero Coach and Hunt, they're both small companies still. And for them, the exposure at World Tour level is like incredible because it kind of validates them a bit as a brand. But also the flip side, they saw the opportunity of going to Quebec or Assos and being able to offer something to the team that's a smaller team, which isn't necessarily, you know, financial input, but it's providing something, which things that are very fundamental for the team that they're going to need anyway.
It's interesting because I think so many people in that time were sort of asking what they could do to help.
Yeah.
And I've had and this is the thing, is that I sort of say the same thing about when, you know, with the recent cases with the, Van Gansing. I'm like, well, those guys, which one was it? With Van Gansing case and the verdict of, you know, a 2-year suspension and people saying, oh, this isn't good. This isn't good enough. And what can we do as people? Well, we can all So what they say is like you vote with your wallet.
Yeah.
And it's the same case in this. It's like people go, oh, we want to donate to Quebec Assets. We want to put in, we want to have a fan thing for the team. Well, it's never going to work and it's never going to be sustainable. But if you love Quebec Assos, go buy a set of Hunt wheels or go buy an Assos jersey or go buy a BMC bike or support any of the people that are supporting them. And when you make that order, if you make it online, put a note in the order that says, I actually bought this because of your support for my favorite team.
Yeah. And it makes
that little thing that goes so long, because when the marketing company sees that in the foot or they get that passed on, they go, right, our sponsorship is working because people are actually buying this. And in the same thing with Van Gensen, like, guess what? Don't support any of the companies that sponsor any of his teams in the future. Like, you don't want that man involved in sport. Make sure that the women that he's trying to sign have better opportunities and they're well-informed and they don't go to that team and don't, and call the sponsors and say, we're going to boycott your company if you work with this guy. Like, we do have the power as fans across the board. And we all need to remember that. So like, you love the team, support it. That's simple.
It is really simple. And I mean, that goes down to, in the simplest way and shape or form that I can think of, is buy the team jersey. Like,
exactly.
There's this percent, I mean, in the UK, 100%, there's this thing about like,
pro kit wankers
and all that, which is bullshit. Like, I've got freaking old Team Sky jerseys that I have them because I just thought they were fucking cool. Like, I've got two or three old Sky jerseys or Dimension Data jerseys, like, just because, and it, to be honest, it's not necessarily that I'm going to wear them, it's that I just really like them as well.
Yeah.
But if I want to wear them, there's no reason why I can't. Like, I hate that whole like pro team wanker thing, is just bullshit. Like,
I think the new jersey that Assos did is really good. The sort of collaboration one.
Yeah. Yeah. There's,
that's a nice blend, you know, you get to be like a team supporter, but not, you know,
You see that a lot of the teams are trying to engage so much more in this opportunity and understanding that that's a good way to work with your fans. And what they're doing is not just offering the race team jersey. I think I saw, the Quebec Assos one with the big hand on it. That's a really lovely jersey. And it looks super, super slick and super smart. Yeah. Katusha did it by having
a whole brand built around it.
Having a brand around it and training style jerseys that were still following the race, the cut and everything in the race team. You look at the likes of, everyone's going to talk about EF with their crazy duck stuff and everything, which is great because that you talk about what EF did at the Giro in 2020, that got more press than anything else.
No, but yeah, I still get so frustrated because I'm like, duh,
it's so simple.
Well, that worked well. And like, I swear JV is probably going to like, you know, if he listens, he's going to be like, fucking Marsh. But like, I want to be very clear about something and I will tell your entire audience that I don't care. There is a reason and everybody knows that any kit change that has to be done through the UCI.
Yeah.
And JV knows that and he purposely didn't do it to make a deal. Oh, we got fined. It's like, you got fined because you didn't tell them on purpose so you could like complain about not getting fined. Come on.
Yeah. You know, it was
like, but it worked. It's marketing and it worked. It was so
brilliant marketing. And it was brilliant marketing because it went outside of cycling.
Yeah.
It took the sport in a position outside of just being people focused looking in on cycling. And that is, in my mind, is one of the ways where cycling needs to evolve a bit more, is figuring out what these unique things are which take the eyes that are not looking at cycling and force them to look at it again.
Well, like, think back to, was it what year? Well, I want to say 2012, when was Specialized Lululemon? I'm going to Google because their kit was amazing.
Yeah.
And that was the same thing. It was so long ago though. And that was, I think that was one of the first examples of like, you know, and you go back to like Rock Racing, although that stuff was horrible. But There it has been around for a long time, this sort of, you know. Specialized Lululemon definitely broke the mold a long time ago with that. And unfortunately may have just been, oh, look, here's the kit. It's just for sale on eBay though.
That was 2012.
So, yeah. And unfortunately maybe it was just ahead of its time for women's stuff, but people were paying attention at that point, but they were then, and Rock Racing, I think, were the first to sort of break the mold on that.
Yeah. And it's not, as you say, it's not a new thing. It's something that's been going on for a while. It's just that it was how Jonathan Walters and the team talked about it. That was what helped add and story to like escalate and everything like that. And
you sort of wonder what's going to come next. And I mean, the team that I'm really watching for this sort of stuff is actually Legion.
Yeah.
Which I just think is like, I just think is the raddest team out there. Like, I'm like, I want to work for them. Like, you know.
Yeah. That team, what feels nice about that team is it's nice how it's just, it's nice that it felt like it was kind of trickling under the woodworks a bit. And then it was like, bam, it's got serious again. And they all, I've not spoken or met any of them, I'll be honest, but they all just seem
you got to get them on the podcast for sure.
I would love to, anyone from that team, because it seems like a really good bunch of people.
Well, we'll just put that in the notes and then we'll talk about that when we're sharing this podcast, and then we'll get, you know, because they've just hired Reed to do their finances and Freddie. So we'll just work through them. We'll get fine.
it's just like anything that is, in my opinion, with cycling, men's and women's side of the sport, anything which is that attracts the attention of the fans and is accessible and slightly different from the old school mentality is a positive. And what I mean,
I think it's the future. Those girls are going to be so happy racing and getting paid to race without, you know, and they're going to do well. And it doesn't fit in this box. Like, pro cycling is so old school.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this is just I am so excited to see where they go and what they do. And it's already so cool. So like Freddie Ovett, he's here in Girona. There's no races here, but he is like, I mean, he's killing it on Zwift, right? And he's so good at it. And he signed for the team to race on the road. But for now, he's racing on Zwift and he's racing gravel, and Specialized love it. And Specialized is so stoked to have somebody doing gravel races in Girona. So he's pulling that whole side in. I mean, it's the future. I also see it a bit actually with Alpes and Phoenix, which hilariously, you know, you gotta love the insider tips. Apparently that is like the hot team. Like every rider wants to go to Alpes and Phoenix. But if you look on their website, it says road team, mountain bike team, gravel team, like, and then they have Planter Pura. I'm like, what's it called? The women's team, which is basically also part of it. And all of those girls are cyclocross riders, but then they're in the Tour of Flanders. And it's like this sort of multidisciplinary thing, which is going to give so much more value for sponsors, give fans so many more levels of engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And it will help riders sort of also have more balance. So Vanderpool wants to race some stuff on the road. He wants to race some cyclocross. He wants to race some mountain bike. Well, now he's not trying to do it for like separate teams.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there under one umbrella for him. And the same for the girls that are racing cross and road. And I think it's... Yeah, and when you start to put men's and women's together as well, you stop having that issue about is women's cycling equal when they have the same sponsors. So
Completely agree. And how we're starting to see more teams accepting that they should have a men's and a women's team.
Yep.
It just makes so much more sense. And I know that from my dealings with Cervelo, I know that part of the agreement of them going to Jumbo-Visma was that a women's team had to be set up. And that's because Cervelo's always insisted that they sponsor a men's and a women's team.
Right, yeah.
From going, it doesn't have to be that it's the same.
But they were with Bigla for so long. And then,
So they've always insisted there's a men's and a women's team. And so seeing, you know, when I was talking to those guys, they were like, we put a bit of pressure on them. Like, to be fair, Jumbo-Visma wanted to do it anyway. Like, it was kind of, they were probably planning on doing it a year earlier, but hadn't quite figured it out on paper. But that was the additional pressure that, you know, Cervelo turned around and said, like, well, if you want our bikes under your team, there needs to be a women's team as well. Because it just makes it so much more, as you say, having the same sponsors, same kit, everything like that. It's just so much more time.
Emma was telling me yesterday how nice it was to be at the classics and like have a chef there and a chef, like the whole like setup, like they have like a meal truck or whatever.
Yeah.
For them, I mean, they never had that before, right? Like women's teams don't. Canyon SRAM has like a chef person, but generally no. So like they, so, you know, for the girls, like, it offers so much, but then for the organization overall, it's saving money if you have like, if you're in one hotel and you can share the resources. So
it does feel like the Movistar team really has like embedded that the teams are training together and they're traveling together and working together. And it seems very.
And Trek as well. Poor Amy. I don't know if you've ever met Amy, the PR girl. She was with CCC and now she's with Trek. I mean, this also makes sense. They do it under one channel, but for some of the Ardennes, she was there for the men's and women's race, and the women's race has started so early.
Yes.
She was like at Flesh for like 14 hours or something, you know.
Such a long day.
Really long day for her. You sort of think she's like, I don't know. That's a whole other conversation, is why they're starting women's races at 8:30 in the morning, but you know.
Yeah. I can't remember what race it was, but the women's race caught up with the men's race and they had to slow the women's race.
I remember that. I can't remember which race it was either, but it was not good.
It was like a couple of years ago, wasn't it? And it was just like, I remember just thinking, just tell the men to fucking stop and
stop, right?
And get out of the way and let the women's race carry on, because if they're just dicking around riding slowly, the cameras should be focused on what's happening on a race where it's attacking and is hyper interesting right now. And
it's sort of interesting because one of the reasons they do start early, and it's one of those things that does get, it's the same thing where people sort of complain about it and you go, okay, so here's actually why. Sorry, guys, but like, do you know how expensive it is per camera, per cameraman? So like, yeah, you could have women's Flesh start at 11 and finish at 3 and men start at the same time and finish at 4, like whatever, you could have it because they start from different places. They won't hit each other, but then you're not going to have them filming the women's finish because there's one helicopter or plane in the sky. There's one live relay going at a time. So
people don't realize that with the pro races, it's not actually, and I was made aware of this when I went to the Tour de France in 2019, is obviously there's the discussion of how many cameras there are on the road, on bikes and stuff. Then you've got to remember there's, from those cameras, there's one helicopter which is taking that signal, and then another helicopter which is transponding that to wherever that's.
And then a plane. And a plane flying around broadcasting it.
Then you've got the helicopters that are flying with the cameras on for the aerial shots. And they're in the Tour de France, I think there's like 3 or 4 of them.
Oh yeah, it's mental, yeah.
And bear in mind that a helicopter can only be in the air for a certain amount of time. It's not a huge amount of time. So you then need multiple helicopters for each one of those positions, because I think they're limited to like an hour or two or something like that in the air. It's not a lot. So yeah, then you're talking... So say, for example, you start off with having 9 helicopters. Realistically, you potentially need 30 helicopters for one stage. And that's the Tour de France. I mean, that's the kind of the pinnacle of it. But even in the smaller races, it's still going to be like 5 or 6 helicopters and the plane to be able to do all of that and broadcast the signals and broadcast it out to everyone. So it is a logistical nightmare.
So it's, everything has its advantages or disadvantages, doesn't it? So like with men's and women's race, you want to put them on the same day so you get the same crowds and the attention is there. Like I think what Flanders Classics does is great. Like that the women's race was a really good solution. Of course, there's always going to be something. So people still say, oh, they only showed the last hour of the race. It's like, well.
It's better than none.
Would you rather start at 8 a.m.? Like, I don't know. It's sort of like, it's always going to be something when you're trying to balance two broadcasts. And like, in the same way, until we all start showing them where the money is and where the value is, it won't change. So what can you do? This is what I always say, is just turn on Eurosport and leave it playing on the background for any women's race, just so they go, oh, the value is there because people are watching it. It's so simple to do stuff, but it's, you know, there is always going to be a balance. And then you could say, okay, that sucked because we all didn't have dinner until 10 p.m. after Flanders because the race ended at 6:30. Well, it's always something, right? So, although these Basque races next week, I'm laughing because they start at 3:30 p.m. And I'm like, this is the most Basque thing ever. So
That's because everyone's had the siesta beforehand.
Yeah. After nap time, yeah. So,
what do you think of, I saw the rescheduled Roubaix. They're doing the men's race on one day and the women's race on a separate day, aren't they?
Might be better for that, just to give, because I think both of those will be fully televised. So,
I agree. Yeah. I think because of the fact that it will be the first women's Roubaix as well, there's going to be so much focus on that. Yeah. Everyone wants to win that race.
I know.
To be the first winner of it, I mean, it'd be incredible. And it's, I feel like it's almost the pressure of it has built up because it's now been delayed, what, realistically, three times.
So many times, right? Yeah. It's just like, I know.
And I'm so glad that it is happening, because I never really understood why it wasn't. And, you know, for me, Roubaix was...
Yeah.
I think I'm not one of the only people that thinks that. I think a lot of people probably were on the same mindset. And I remember Specialized did a video of it about it, and just like talking about why it wasn't happening. And for, you know, there's no reason why it shouldn't. It shouldn't have ever been a discussion point. And the fact that it is, and, you know, it got confirmed and it's got built up and up and up. And now I think it's at that point of...
Everyone's been three times. It's like,
it almost feels like it's jinxed in a weird way. Fingers crossed. Like, I mean, I really do have my fingers crossed that one does happen, because it's gonna be incredible. Like, I think the women's edition is going to be better to watch than the men's. And what I mean on that is, as we've already sort of discussed about, you literally can't predict it. There's maybe 10 riders that you could go, maybe this person, but there's so many outside bets on that one. And I don't think you tend to get that so much in the men's race.
Who's going to hold form until October? What's going to happen? Who knows? Like, you know, in the classic for the girls as well. Like, and if you think about it, the girls haven't had any stage races yet, basically. Like, there's a little thing here or there, right? Or Elsie Jacobs, do you count that? It's prologue in two stages, but, you know, they now start sort of more for them the stage racing season. Yeah. So to take Roubaix and then throw it back in October is sort of like, what's going to happen? Because you just don't know, you know. And one of the reasons that I think that you see Anna and Annemiek do so well is that Anna and Annemiek are both riders that do very well at targeting certain races. And so they don't, as well, having teams that they can say that, you know, Annemiek can go right, so this one's for Emma, like, you know, I'm out. And the same thing for Anna, having a team that she can, you know, you saw her celebrate Demi Vollering the other day. Like, you know, Anna said flesh. Was she, you know, and she's good all the time, but is she truly targeting all of them? Can she take a rest at some of them? Is she trying to win Dwars, Dwars, Flander? And probably not. Like, she's going, these are the ones I want to. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when you take Roubaix and separate it out of that classic season. Is everybody going to be absolutely pinging for like this one-day race? Like, is it going to be the World Championships again? I think it could be.
And the World Championships is a week later, I think.
Right, exactly. And it's also there, so.
It's basically the same road. So it's going to be, I mean, yeah, it's Belgium, isn't it? It's just going to be, that period is going to be insane. It's like, I read a tweet that Luke Rowe put out talking about he was wrecking the World Champs course, and he just wrote something like, just wrecked the World Champs course, it is absolutely brutal, it will be amazing to watch. That is pretty much it.
And apparently
it's like Flanders on crack, apparently they just said.
Yeah, but the first half is like Flanders on crack, and then it's like an Ardennes.
Yeah.
So it's actually really interesting, because Nathan's favorite races are the Ardennes, right? Like, and he hates the cobbles. So I mean, he's on the list for Australia at this point, but he's like, oh, I was gonna get through the first half. Because I mean, in the women's peloton, those, like, all the riders tend to do Ardennes and Cobble Classic. Men's are a handful of people that will do both.
So I
think it's gonna be so interesting to see the dynamic between the two halves. And like, because of that, as opposed to like the sort of race where they go, okay, so like, let's let a break go for the first half of it. Are the classics riders going to try to use the first half to shake all the smaller guys to survive the second? Like, I think it's going to be so interesting. My response was, well, maybe they should just like make it a relay.
That's a good way to mix it up.
Two winners, two-man teams, yeah.
World champs to a relay. That'd be... I'd watch it.
I mean, look, to be honest, controversial opinion. I think that the world championship should be a three-day race and it should be the overall winner from it. But I think it's so random. Like, I actually love the women's leaders jersey.
Yeah.
And I wish they had that for men.
Yeah. It's
I don't know why they don't.
It makes so much sense, doesn't it? I just...
Because if you like, you know, if somebody starts in Australia, like Richie would have it at first, and then Trek would get to be like, we have the leader. Not that Trek doesn't have enough world champions, but you know, national champions, all of them. But then they would have something to talk about. It always helps with marketing just to have something like that. I don't know why they don't.
Yeah, I don't think I completely agree. Like it feels weird that it isn't in the men's peloton when it is in the women's as well.
Yeah,
and it, as you say, it's nice because it gives. It becomes a special jersey, like for riders to target and aim for, and I just think it adds, as you say, it becomes a great marketing thing. It adds a bit more to some of the smaller races as well. Yep. Like it adds.
And they used to have it. I mean, dare I say, you're gonna be like, oh my god, I remember like it must have been 2012. I want to say that John Tiernan Locke had the European leaders jersey.
Yeah.
So they used to have it. Dare I say that name aloud?
Say that one under your breath, that name.
But that it's disappeared. I don't remember. I mean, and I think Nathan, at one point, he would have had an Oceana's leaders jersey back in the day, a long time ago. But they should be back. Because the thing is, world championships and national championships, all of that, it's a one-day race. It can be really arbitrary, right? Like. I mean, I think we all would have been surprised if Trenton had been world champion, for instance. So, and you do get these sort of random ones that you're like, okay, I always think like, you know, there should be something else about it. It is what it is. It's a one day race, but why not have like a constant leader's jersey?
Yeah. So. Yeah, I agree. And when you say about like Trenton being world champion, that would have been there's no denying he's an incredibly talented bike rider, but I think it would have been one that people would have been a bit like, oh,
yep.
And then, Mads Pedersen, another example. No one expects him to win it.
Nobody expected him to win.
And what's so sad is that he hardly got to wear the jersey, really.
I know. I was just checking the rankings. Oh, look, it's broken on the UCI. So let's try to reload that. Nope. Data.ride.uci refused to connect. Well, it won't tell me the rankings, but you could all, you know, yeah. It rewards people that race more, it rewards strong rides.
It's definitely a thing that could, I don't know, how do we make it happen?
I don't know. I think pro cycling stats should be allowed to have one from theirs as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And yeah, I completely agree with you on that topic. It's a cool thing in the women's peloton. And I also really like that it has the jerseys changed hands quite a lot over the last, you know, this season already, and we're what are we in May, and it feels like the jersey's been on the shoulders of what, like four or five different riders, I would say.
Yeah, they keep going back and forth between this, but then the young riders jersey as well is nice to sort of encourage development. Although, granted, I mean, I think for the men's racing at least, there should no longer be a young riders jersey. There should be an old riders jersey because the young riders are winning everything. It should definitely be the silver jersey for like best placed over 30.
Yeah. Or is it a case that they lower the age of the young riders category?
Possibly, but I still think a silver jersey for the old fuckers would be fucking amazing.
Yeah. Who's the wiliest fox out there?
Yeah, and then you get like, or maybe you push it up to like 35 and like Greipel will get something, you know. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how many riders are there? I mean, in the women's peloton, there is quite a large proportion of older, I say older, it's still not old, but older riders in the women's peloton. In the men's peloton, plus 35, there aren't a huge amount.
It's been a game of the young right now.
Plus 35, specifically, I'm saying, like, there's not a huge amount plus that. As you say, Greipel, Cav, is he 35?
Valverde.
Okay. he's his own category for many reasons.
They are a pile. I mean, how old's Van Avermaet?
I don't think he's as old as people think.
Oh, he's just been around for ages. It feels like Gilbert,
yeah, it's another example. God, there's not a huge amount that you can think of, really. Mm. Not that I can think of off the top of my head, really. I'm trying to think now. I'm like busting my brain. I don't even know.
I think there's some other truth in the fact that we're at a time period right now that if you are over 35, male pro cyclist, you were most likely on a team when you were 19 or 20 that could have been had more systematic doping in it.
Hmm.
So, you know, if you're one of those really young guys, like maybe you were in and then you were out really quickly. Like there's a weird age gap where there's a few guys that are in their late 30s that were definitely still, they were around when that was still the norm.
Yeah.
And then there's a bit of a gap of a few years. And then there's some younger guys. And so it's either the case, I'm not going to get in trouble for like slender or anything, where like there were guys that were in teams that were doing this and they have a performance benefit because from their first days. And not my business to blame anybody, especially when every team is doing it. It's like, okay, so that's what was happening. It wasn't right, but guess what?
Everyone was doing
it. But it is like, yeah. So, and maybe they still have a performance benefit. So they're still going later into their career. I am not accusing anybody of doing anything now, but then you have this gap of like the guys that came right after that maybe they're just 35 and they're too old. So.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. And yeah. I mean, the thing is on the subject of doping is that it's, what almost frustrates me somewhat about it is that it's always brought up in terms of cycling, but it is rife in other sports.
I know.
Like, I know. This is what a lot of people don't realize. And I mean, I've heard stories from people that work in journalism of other sports. I'm not necessarily going to say what the sports are or anything like that, but I think it's pretty obvious if you follow what are the big sports globally and say the biggest sport probably in the UK, but there's a lot of stuff which just doesn't quite add up. To term with physique of certain men and recovery rates and that kind of thing. And I mean, stuff has come out about like steroid injections to cover up injuries and things like that. But yeah, I've heard from friends who are journalists in other sports that the reason why it hasn't come out is because of how much that sport is valuable to said newspaper, magazine, whatever it is.
Not me overall.
And it won't come out until someone comes out about it and kind of goes, fuck it, I'm going to bust the gut on this and put it out there. Unfortunately, and
speaking of unnamed other sports, have you seen Ted Lasso, the TV show?
No, go on.
You should. It's on Apple TV. Write it down. It'll make you want to be involved in every. You know, we're not going to say what sport it's about, but I'm pretty sure Ted said one. So.
Yeah, I know this. I know the. I was trying to think with the guy who's in it, but I know who it is. It's
bloody brilliant. Everybody watch it. It makes you. It's how cycling should be run.
Yeah, so. That is a series. I've seen it on Apple TV, but I haven't watched it. And it's come up.
You'll watch it all in one night, I'm telling you.
I'm currently doing, in the UK, the big one at the moment has been Line of Duty.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Is it good?
I started watching it about 3 weeks ago from series one. I've nearly finished. Okay. It's very good.
How many
good.
Series are there?
Six.
Okay, so it is good. Okay.
I don't know. I won't give anything away to you or anyone, but I'm about halfway through series six and shit's going down, basically.
Well, perfect timing because you're almost out and then you can watch Ted Lasso.
Yeah, I need a new
Ted
series.
Lasso to come coach a cycling team for like a week or two.
Yeah, that'd be a good solution.
It would be brilliant. So
I think, I'm nearly finished with it and I would recommend it. It's not normally the kind of series I would watch.
Is it scary?
It's all about like crime in the UK, basically. There's murders and drug stuff going on. But part of it for me is that what's really stupid is that serious dramas like that, because it is quite serious and the kind of topics it does discuss at points are incredibly serious, in fact. But I somehow seem to find something amusing about every character in it.
Okay.
Which I shouldn't do, but there's something about every single character that ends up being right. something that I can't stop but sort of chuckle about.
Right.
And
is it like, oh, I know somebody that's just like that sort of thing?
Well, one of the main guys is like a really small man who always wears waistcoats. And he's like, oh, mate, he's like a proper like East London.
Right. We all know somebody like that, don't
yeah.
we?
Yeah. I used to go to, yeah. I went to uni with someone that just reminds me exactly of him. And then like one of the other main guys is like Irish, and I'm not sure if he's Irish or Northern Irish, but he's got a very thick accent and is quite religious and also a Mason. So all of that's quite interesting as a dynamic.
Okay, I'll wait for Mason so we can watch it together.
Yeah. So I would recommend watching it differently. It's probably
my greatest lockdown achievement was rewatching all of Seinfeld. So
the thing is, that's where lockdown.
So
yeah, lockdown's worked out good for things like that, hasn't it?
It's still so good. I wasn't sure because I was a little bit young when it first came out that I didn't really get it. Like my parents watched it and I was like I knew the characters and I thought that Kramer was really funny, but I didn't know like why it was funny. And now I'm like, oh my God, this is genius. So.
I did the whole of The American Office again.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. We've all been upskilling during lockdown, haven't we? So.
I love The American Office. It's better than the English one. I don't care what anyone says. It's so much more funny. And it the fact that it carries on for however many seasons it is, I don't know, what, 7, 8, 9 seasons?
Isn't it? Yeah. And
they don't, I mean, it does drop off a bit when Steve Carell leaves, I think. Yeah. But then it does also, that like the season that afterwards is a bit naff, but then the seasons following that are very, very good again. So I'm a
big fan of the, what is it, when they do the gift giving and he puts in an iPod for the Secret Santa or whatever. And it's supposed to be like a $10 limit and he puts an iPod in. I'm like, because there's always that asshole that does that, isn't there?
Yeah.
Like one person that like ignores the limit and you're like, fuck.
There's so many things on that series that are so relatable. Anyone that's worked in an office, and I think that's what I like about the American Office is the British office is equally as relatable, but it's very British humor. Like I don't think it quite translates so well maybe internationally, and also it's very dated humor. It's very top of the time. The American one is a bit more, the humor kind of is a bit more timeless, and it's
maybe this is like a cross-cultural thing though, because like I love British humor more than anything.
Maybe. Yeah. I think like, maybe I just get fed up with it because I hear it day to day all the time.
Like I also will watch old episodes of Mock the Week from like 5 years ago and not care that it is like I will still laugh so hard. And it's like, oh, they're talking about, you know, Theresa May.
Yeah. Have you?
And it's still so funny to me.
Have you done Taskmaster? Oh my God. Taskmaster, watch it. It's brilliant.
Right. So
Taskmaster is on, it's now on Channel 4, and it's basically a TV series. There is actually, it has been done in America as well. And,
okay.
But I've not watched the American ones, but the British ones, what it is, you've got two guys that create, every series is a panel of 5 comedians, basically.
Okay.
And there's 2 presenters. And they basically do a series of, during the series, the panel of comedians have to do tasks. And the tasks can be very, very, absolutely anything. And they can be, quite often you can interpret the task in different ways because of how it's written.
Okay.
There's some of the tasks are quite intelligent. And like, there's a bit where you're like, why the fuck didn't I think that in it? But it is brilliant.
Check it out.
The people that are in it is like Noel Fielding's in it in one series. And there's a real contrast though of like up and coming like comedians and actors to more like mainstream, more well-known guys as well. So it's a really good mix. And the two guys that present it and write all the tasks are hilarious as well. There's just a lot of good banter between them. And I think that's on like 9 seasons now. So it's been going for quite a while. And there's a Taskmaster game, which I will put it out there, is probably one of the best Christmas games I've ever played.
I'm going to try to find Taskmaster anywhere in Spain that I can watch it.
It's got to be able to find.
Oh, we are so awesome. Now I feel really bad. All the listeners are going to be like, they are just literally talking shit about video, about movies and TV.
So on the topic of games, haven't you done a game?
So two friends in London and Nathan, as their celebrity spokesperson, created a cycling game called Attack the Pack. They'll be very happy to hear. So it's actually super cute. It's a little bit complicated, but it is a cool like card game type thing about cycling. Yeah, they had a lot of fun doing it.
So it's really cool. And it's really cool. Yeah. I've not played it, but I will probably end up buying it now, to be honest with you.
Buying it now.
But what I really like all the little illustrations on it.
Yeah, the illustrations were done by a girl named Adrian who lives in London. Adrian illustrates on Instagram. She's super talented, so that was good. There was one that was like kind of Nathan-like, which was cute. So,
So if you don't look it up, if you don't know Attack the Pack, and check it out because it's pretty cool. Little, like, I just think the illustrations are really nice, which is maybe that's just my mentality of liking anything pretty and designed. I just thought it was really like they're nice and fun and friendly.
Yeah.
And then the one last thing which I'm going to ask, I don't know if I pre-warned you or not, I can't remember, is I always ask people for 5 tips. I didn't pre-warn you.
Five tips?
Anything. So what this can...
Don't eat yellow snow?
That's one. Done. Okay, perfect. Cool. And the reason why it's always 5 is because 3 is easy, 4 is hard, 5, the normally the 5th one's really, really good. And I don't always pre-warn people because I like it. They can be anything from don't eat yellow snow, very valid point. I've had cooking tips. I've had tips to like maintaining your bike. I've had like really deep like meaning of life tips. I've had things which have just literally been like drink 8 glasses of water a day. Like it could literally be anything, but 5 of them. And you've done one already. Don't eat yellow snow. And it can be anything from what you've learned from your life and absolutely anything. That's it always. And I've sort of been insisted on doing it now because I had so many people complain that I didn't do it for a while.
I'm still stuck on don't eat yellow snow.
Don't eat red snow.
Don't eat red snow. Does that count as 2? Oh, that's so gross.
That is really gross, but I would cast that as 2.
Man, it's just so frustrating because I'm going to finish and I'm going to be like, oh, I forgot about all of those ones.
Go on, there's got to be something. Don't
really bad on the spot.
That's why this is always so good, because people...
You can edit this, right? You can take out this, so it's not like 10 minutes of like long pauses of me being like...
Yeah, that's cool.
Tip 2. Always buy everything secondhand. Better for everything. Better for everything, better value. You're doing somebody else a favor. You're probably contributing to a small business or an individual, and it's better for the environment. So
that's a great tip.
Which I don't know if you saw this morning that Cole Nago has launched an NFT of a bike, and like I'm crying because nobody seems to understand how bad this stuff is for the environment. I'm like, could you stop with these stupid NFTs? Like, it's not a thing. We're just killing the world. Stop. Like,
I saw it and I just thought, I think my reaction was, that's pretty much what I did. That is how I could sum up my reaction. And the caption that I haven't read like there's a press release or anything, but the caption I saw on social media made me just go again. Because it's
Tip 3.
Go on.
All about how you look at things. So don't ever let, so like for instance, you know, I have an American coffee pot in the house because I like to go out and enjoy my coffee. And my coffee here is going to go through a filter and it's going to make quantity over quality. And it's 12 cups at once. Well, you know what I'm going to tell you? I can't find a single difference between that and when you have a pour over coffee in a cafe. It's the exact same process.
Yep.
I'm sorry. So ignore labeling call it what you want. It's all the same. Do what makes you happy. It's just how you look at it. So I was like, you know, I make that joke that I'm like, oh yeah, we have a pour over machine. And people are like, ooh, and then they see it and it's an American coffee pot for like $30. So
that's,
yeah.
I'm with that because like I have a cafetiere that I've had for 14 years, I think. 14, maybe 15 years now. It's disgusting, but it does the same thing as a cafetiere from anywhere. Yeah. Like, yeah. And it just works.
It's the works.
The handle's broken on it. You have to hold it with an oven mitt.
Perfect.
That's fine. It's bright. It's red and it's covered in coffee stains and it's a bit crappy, but the coffee still comes out good.
You know, the Bialetti, they tell you not to wash it. So it like makes more of a rich flavor. So I guess you're on the same thing. And it's probably like the best coffee you'll ever have for life. So, tip four. I don't know. I've run out again. I have no knowledge of anything.
You definitely do. There's definitely something about, I could think of a fourth one quite easily, and it's just simply about always, for me, from what we've talked about, what I think about is that how it's always about like just being positive and like forthcoming and open to talk.
Always be positive, but not on a drug test. There you go.
That'll do.
Tip four.
Actually, no, there is no drug test you want to be positive on. I was trying to think if there's anything I can think of.
Or not even a COVID test. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've had. Yeah,
that should be my new slogan. Always be positive, but not on a drug test.
Okay. Very true. Very true. Yeah. I'd have a COVID test the other day and I don't like them. But...
horrible. They're so horrible.
The nose stick is bad enough. The throat, every time I've had that, I think I'm going to throw up.
Mm-hmm. It's all so bad. It's like, what are you getting out of there? Like,
but I understand why, you know, if it means being able to see people and stuff, I get it. But it's not an enjoyable experience. And I had to have I had to have blood tests yesterday as well. And I am not good with needles, injections, or anything like that.
Close your eyes. I use my mouth mask to cover my eyes.
my partner's she's a volunteer giving vaccines to people as well. She's had all the training. You had to go through like a little training with the British Red Cross and stuff, and she's had all that done. And she's volunteers and gives injections. She was like, "Would you let me do your COVID injection when you can have it?" And I was like, "Yes," because. Mm-hmm. You could deal with me afterwards.
Right.
But the blood test was like it's pretty simple. It was just like the pinpricks in the fingers and just having to fill up these vials of blood.
Mm.
I absolutely hated it. I thought it was going to faint. Literally, I thought it was going to faint. And then you just post them away, basically. But I have very legitimate reasons for not being good with hospitals and doctors, which I'm sure at some point I'll end up talking about. But it's to do with operations that went wrong when I was a kid. And those kind of things are implemented in you for the rest of your life, unfortunately. Anything medical related, not fun. But we've still got one more tip to do.
I know, I was hoping you'd forgotten about that. And now it's the last one, so that's like the hardest. That's like all the, you know, you're gonna get like a series of text messages from me after that are like, oh, here's a better one.
Let me just record a voice note of an even better one.
I know, I've just thought of something way better.
I mean where I was going when I was on my slight tangent was talking about how, you know, you're obviously very in tune with what's kind of going on in pro cycling and the riders out there and everything like that. And what I think is very clear is how you are very positive about that whole situation and who you meet and who you discuss. You're never negative about it publicly, anyway. because what you can say can be very influential on what can end up happening further down the line. Does that make any sense? It makes sense in my head.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. I think I did have a rant or two about the EF kick. Come on, that wasn't necessarily a positive.
I wouldn't class that as being negative. That's raising a point of the situation. I mean in the context of like going, you're not bitching about anyone. That's a more negative word that I mean. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because I think you can, I don't know, maybe I just feel like everybody has something to offer. So, you know, there's also everybody you meet, there's probably going to be something you don't like about them as well. But, you know,
yeah,
it's always, everybody has something, not offer like physically, but offer, you know, every person that you meet has different experiences that you can learn from and share from. And so just take everybody for face value. Recognize that everybody you meet has an interesting and unique story and work out what you can learn from them. Is that a tip?
Tips. And I class that one.
Always save time to go to the beach.
Which is what you're doing this afternoon. Is
what I'm doing today.
God damn it. I am not, because there's one, no beach near me, and two, it's fucking freezing outside. So
I think that if you were at a beach near you, it would be pretty miserable. So.
Yeah. I mean, at least it's blue skies now. It was pretty grim and overcast earlier, but it's blue skies now, which is, I have to be honest, since I've moved here, every morning and every evening, the sunrises and sunsets have been unbelievable. Like, I guess because living in central London, I didn't get that. You're just covered in light pollution and noise pollution. Yeah. But since being here, it's been, because the house I'm in is it's a converted textile factory.
Oh, wow. So okay.
Super high ceilings and the massive, massive like floor to ceiling windows and stuff like that. So all the light comes flooding in, and it's really, really special, actually. I'll send you a photo of it later, actually, because it's stunning.
I mean, I'm sure you'll do a Girona cycling trip at some point. You just come to the beach here.
Oh, man. I am longing to get back to Girona, to be honest with you. I haven't. It's probably been 2 years.
Shit. Yeah, well, I mean,
I can't imagine much has changed in 2 years.
There's probably another like bike cafe or something that's opened.
Probably another bike cafe, probably another 10 bike cafes, probably a few more people than last time. Everyone's got a bit older, but nothing.
Bikes have gotten nicer. More people are riding gravel.
Last time I went, gravel wasn't really.
I know.
I mean, it was kind of starting, but no one was really doing it. But yeah, I'm very, as soon as I basically already said to my partner, like as soon as it's kind of deemed safe to travel a bit more, we're going to go to Girona.
Because you're into the gravel thing too, aren't you?
Yeah, it's just fun.
I know.
It's just fun. And like, I don't know, I think there's a lot of really good gravel in the UK. Tons of it. And I think there's also a lot of really bad drivers in the UK. And you go gravel riding on some of the old like fire tracks and stuff like that, you're just taken away from an element that can cause danger. And admittedly, since I've moved up to the Peak District, the drivers have been a lot better. But my comparison is London, where drivers are generally bell ends. I'm going to put it out there. You know, up here when I've been out for rides, a car could be stuck behind you for like 10 minutes and they don't care. It's fine. But London, it's, you know, if someone's stuck behind you for 10 seconds, they get arsey.
Yeah.
I think a big part of it is because the British cycling riders and riders that are in the British Cycling British Academy, they ride in the Peak District a lot because Manchester is the closest like national park. So I think there's a lot of like acknowledgement that there's a lot of like high level pro riders riding around here.
It's quite historical in the north too. Like, I mean, Tour of Yorkshire, like the crowds in that. I'm so sad that races got canceled again. I hope it comes back, but like it's really, the people really love it up there.
So. Yeah, it's massive, you know. Yorkshire, Peak District, Lake District, the kind of that band across the UK. Cycling is a massive like pulse of the area. You know, people absolutely love it. They live and breathe it. And I think that that was a big reason for wanting to move up here. Because it's just amazing roads, yeah. incredible trails, like, and people are much more susceptible and open and like it, quite frankly. Yeah.
And Kendall Mint Cake. That stuff's good.
I've got to be honest, I'm not a fan, but I don't really like minty things. But they've
All right, how close are you to that really nice service station? You know where I'm talking about, though.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like my knowledge of Northern England. I'm like, there's this one motorway station that's so fancy.
There's one in Gloucester or Gloucestershire, somewhere like that, that is a farm shop. And that might be the one you mean.
No, this is North. This is maybe it's Lake District. Teabay? Where's Gloucestershire? Yeah. I don't know where the Peak District is compared to the Lake District. I get really confused, I'll be honest. Peak
is, Lake District is more north.
Okay.
So Peak District is kind of Sheffield.
Okay.
So basically, if that's the Peak District, Sheffield is like on the eastern coast. Manchester is like slightly north.
So the Peaks are the thing that's between Manchester and Sheffield.
Yeah, basically.
I stayed there once in that park. It's really nice. I was like, oh, I've been there.
And where I am is a little village in the the west of the Peaks. Well, I say village. It's a small town. And it's from my doorstep to the basically being in the Peak District is, I think, 2 kilometres.
Okay.
I mean, it's... Yeah. Up a fucking big hill, but
it's good training.
Yeah, it's 15k climb and it's got 20% plus bits on it, so it's but you can go round it, but that's the most direct route into the Peak District. I can't remember what it's called now, but it my coach's dad does currently live in a town across from me, and he comes up here anyway for riding around Christmas and stuff, and he's like, that climb by you is the only climb I've gone up and thought I'm going to stop ever. And I was like,
this one.
That bodes well.
Yep.
Anyway, Laura, thank you.
Better run. All right. If you need anything else, let me know. If you're like, this is horrible, we got to redo it, just tell me. So that's fine.
Thank you so much for your time.
Send me all when it's going to be out, and then we'll tweet about it and get Legion to go on because they just shared something. That we'll get them on there.
Have a really good time at the beach. I'm really jealous.
What's funny is I'm actually a little bit sunburned from the other day from just sitting outside for too long, and I'm like, but I'm going anyway. So
a slight look at that, slight bit of colour.
There you go.
Yeah, a bit of British sun there. Yeah, not much. Yep. We had about 5 days where it was glorious.
Yep.
And that was it.